Good morning. Welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning, John.
We have an intriguing show for you this morning. Dr. Thelma Lobel, author of Sensation, The New Science of Physical Intelligence. Thelma is an internationally recognized psychologist and professor at the School of Psychological Science at Tel Aviv University, where she is the director of the Child Development Center. Color, temperature, darkness, texture, all these sensations influence our inner world and our actions with unexpected power. In her book, Sensation, Lobel tells us about the influence of physical intelligence, and she reveals that physical experiences unconsciously affect our everyday decisions and choices with profound implications to our everyday life.
I like this.
Yeah.
Is that like the little dance you were doing across the table from me? Somehow that affects.
I love our theme music, and you were dancing too.
Okay, I was. Our second guest this morning is David Waltham, author of Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. In Lucky Planet, astrobiologist Waltham argues that Earth's climate stability is one of the primary factors that makes it able to support life, and nothing short of luck made such conditions possible. The 4 billion year stretch of good weather that our planet has experienced is statistically so unlikely, he shows that chances are slim we'll never encounter intelligent extraterrestrial others. Yeah, well, all that plus today's cool story when we return. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest is Dr. Thelma Lobel, author of Sensation, The New Science of Physical Intelligence. She reveals that physical experiences unconsciously affect our everyday decisions and choices. Lynn, this is definitely cool science. Dr. Lobel's research tells us that people are more likely to cheat on tests or lie on surveys right after taking a shower. Or consider that sitting in a soft chair makes people more likely to be flexible in negotiations. I want to do a call out to all single men in the Wasatch Front. You will have a better chance at getting a woman's telephone number if you ask her where an aroma of fresh pastry is present.
I thought that only worked for selling your house. But anyway, go ahead.
We're going to talk about these examples and many more with our next guest. Dr. Lobel, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, you know, Lynn and I both very much enjoyed your book. And
thank you.
Yeah, tell us about physical intelligence and why you wrote this book.
Well, actually, why I wrote this book is an interesting question, because for years, you know, I wanted to write something for the general audience, not only for researchers and students. And I was doing studies on gender differences before and played with the idea that I'll do that because I all the time wrote more academic articles. And then I just started reading about this subject that we'll elaborate in a minute about and what it's called actually embodied cognition. And it was so fascinating that I decided that I will do my next year's I'll do research on that, and I will write a book for the general audience because I really thought this information should be spread not only among researchers.
We are such sensuous beings as humans, aren't we?
Yeah. So, yeah. So what I call physical intelligence is called usually embodied cognition, which means that our mind and bodies work together and that our cognitions, our thoughts, our decisions, our emotions are grounded in our physical sensations, which means that when we see something or touch something warm or touch something soft or hard or heavy or light, it affects our behavior, and more importantly, without being aware to that. For example, if can I give an example?
Please.
Of course.
Sure. So, for example, if people, there were two groups of participants who were given a resume of a job candidate, but one group was holding it on a heavy clipboard, while the other participants of the other group were holding it on a light clipboard, the same resume was judged as more important, and the candidate was judged as a better fit for the job simply because his resume was on a heavier clipboard.
Exactly.
Now, they never thought that was the reason, of course. So that's one example, and I could go on and on because it's really fascinating. You just asked me the question.
Yeah, well, you have at least a couple of chapters on temperature, and there was one particular study where the participants came into an elevator to go up to have the study done, and they were handed a beverage. Some were handed a warm cup of tea. Some were handed iced tea. Can you tell us about that?
Sure, but it was coffee, not tea.
Oh, okay.
But the same results would have come, I
right.
imagine. Yeah, that's the study that really influenced me. It was done by William and Barge from Yale University, published in Science, really the top journal. And what was done there, that the participants came to the experiment, like you said, and each participant, while accompanied in the elevator, was asked by the experimenter, could you please hold my cup of coffee for a minute while I'm writing your name? You know, it took a few seconds. And as you said, half got it touched a warm cup of coffee and half an iced coffee. Then they came to the lab, and they were asked to evaluate person A on various characteristics. And the amazing result was that those who held in the elevator before the study a hot cup of coffee judged that person as a warmer person, more friendlier, nicer, than those who held a cold cup of coffee in the elevator. Now, these researchers did another study just, you know, to complete it. They asked two groups of participants to hold a therapeutic pad as if they were participating in a marketing research. Half were holding a hot cup, therapeutic pad, and the other half a cold therapeutic pad. And then they were asked questions as if they were participating in a marketing study. Then they were offered as a reward for their participation that they could choose between a present for themselves or a gift for a friend. More people who were holding a warm therapeutic pad chose a gift for a friend than those who were holding a cold therapeutic pad. That means they were more generous.
This is all good stuff. And I think that, Thelma, you know, when you were talking about the elevator and you said, well, it was actually tea, not coffee, coffee, not tea. So it made me think, well, maybe then the smell had something to do with the particular warm or cold substance. And as we know, that smell is one of our sharpest senses, but it is very, very subtle, very sublime, an unconscious sense. It affects us on a very deep level that we're not aware of sometimes, but not so much with this mind-body connection. I mean, it's all the stories that you tell in your book are things that really we can see or we can touch. They're very conscious sorts of elements. And I find it interesting, you know, that there are still sort of mysteries around it, and we can still, you know, like the baking bread, if you're trying to sell your house, bake some bread so it smells good when the prospective buyers come in. That's an age-old secret, right?
Yeah. That's something that people, you know, especially agents know that all the time. They say baked bread or cookies are very good for selling your house. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, but these are things that we know. We've known this for decades, and yet it still works. And if I'm going to sell my house, there's no way I'm going to have, you know, buyers show up without it smelling like cookies or bread or something.
If I understand your question, you ask me that even if we know it still affects us, not always, not necessarily. Definitely, it helps to know because we are manipulated all the time without knowing it. sometimes intentionally and sometimes not intentionally. For example, if you know that that some a tall guy is perceived usually as more powerful, and you know that it might affect you, you're more conscious to perceive that person for what he or she is rather than the height. Or if you're sitting on a soft chair, as you said in the beginning of the program, there are several studies that show that you will become a softer negotiator. You will change your initial offer more. So once you know that, you may be more conscious. And on the other hand, you can use this information for your own good when you're negotiating, either business negotiation or interactions with your children or your spouse. When you want to talk about something really serious, you have to think about the softness of the chair, the beverage you will serve, the distance between you, the height of the chair. All these things affect us, and the more we know, I think the less we'll be manipulated and the more we can use them for our benefit.
That's right. That's exactly what I was hoping to elicit, what you would say about that and about neuroscience in general. I mean, the more we know about it, still it doesn't negate its effect.
Exactly. But it helps. It definitely helps. I know, I can tell you from my own experience. In the last 4 years, all I'm doing is doing research on that and writing the book all the time and giving several courses in university on that. So I'm thinking about it all the time. And I find myself more conscious to that. You know, I don't know if these things don't affect me. I'm sure they do. But they probably less than they were affecting me before I started thinking about all these things. And definitely I can think, you know, when I'm negotiating with somebody and he's holding or she's holding a warm beverage, I'm thinking about it. It comes to my mind. Maybe that will influence her or him to think that I'm a warmer person. Maybe he will behave in a warmer way, which is for my own good. So I'm thinking about it, and I think it helps. And there are, you know, things that we didn't talk about colors, the red color, all these things, what were. I could talk about it if you want. They affect us, and once I know the information, I can use it.
Yes, exactly. We definitely want to talk about the red color, but before we do, I just wanted to say one more thing about real estate. I was reading your book over the weekend, and I was thinking about architecture, and you can walk into two different homes that have nearly identical layouts. One home, and let's say that they're both designed by the same architect and they're built by the same person. One home has wood floors, off-white walls, maybe some nice furniture and some nice traditional lights. The other home is sort of a symphony of tactile surfaces, wood floors, stone floors, copper, granite, stone arches, grass paper, indirect, interesting light. One home feels a little cool to the touch. It's okay, but it's a little cool to the touch. The other home just seems intimate. And I think it has a lot to do with these tactile surfaces that you're talking about.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And people don't think about it. I think really that people think about warm and cold colors. They don't think so much about the texture. I mean, people really don't think till they read these articles and findings that really just the fact that you touch a rough surface or you walk on a rough surface, like you said, influences how rough you will behave or, I mean, you will perceive the interaction. And the studies show that just the fact that people touched a rough or smooth surface, they made them judge the interaction differently. The same interaction were judged as more competitive, they judge it as an argument rather than a discussion just because they touch something rough compared to those who touch something smooth. So it really affects the way we judge other people and the way we behave. And sometimes it's so important because some decisions make the whole difference, even if they're on the spot.
Well, of course, you never see a negligee that's made out of rough burlap. Maybe there's something there. Maybe the clothing industry knows something. I mean, obviously, these companies that put all this money into marketing, they sort of have a heads up on this, don't they, Thelma?
Yeah, they should know actually when to make clothes more softer, and that goes for blankets and for towels and for all these things.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to ask you about the new advances in neuroscience, and sometimes neuroscience gets a bad rap for just making, you know, those who market things to us a little bit more finely tuned, which, you know, all comes back to this large-scale deception that, you know, we often think that companies who want to sell us something, you know, have over us. And so, you know, neuroscience has been around probably in its, you know, elemental form for decades, for a century. But what are the new elements of neuroscience that are really shaping it into, you know, something that you're writing about?
I'm not sure I will be able to answer all the elements that there are, but one of the things that people are investigating lately, and this is, I call, the second generation of these studies, and there are other aspects that I call second generation that I'll go in a minute, is the fMRI, using the functional MRI, which actually shows which parts of your brain are activated while you are reading something or memorizing something. And what it found out, for example, is that when people were hearing metaphors, I had a hard day, for example, so you use the word hard, mm-hmm. or you can say a sentence with the same meaning but without the metaphor, my day was not good or something like that. They found that when a person hears, I had a hard day, the same region in the brain region is activated as when that person touches a hard object. But when that person hears a sentence with the same meaning, but it has not the metaphor, without the metaphor, without using the word hard, other regions are activated. So this is one way that neuroscience is progressing to combine what I'm talking about, the way the mind and body work together, and how really what's going on in the brain.
Well, you know, you had an example in your book about if a woman is taking a science, and correct me if I'm wrong, if a woman is taking a science test and she has to put her name down or check a box that says that she's female, there's some association with the fact that women are not supposed to be good in science. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was something like that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. This was an example that actually this is not new. This is something old that I just gave an example. It's what is called stereotype threat. A long time ago already, the researchers showed that once you ask a person to write his or her gender or race, and they're taking mathematical tests, which are the stereotype says that women are less competent in mathematical tests. Just the fact that you ask my gender will make me perform worse. The same with race. Some races, the stereotype, like African American, the stereotype is that they are not that good in mathematics. Then just the fact that they ask them, what is your race, decrease their performance. And then I give an example about how the color red influences our performance, which is also amazing. Just the fact that people had their red participant number written at the top of the right top of their page of the test, compared to other groups who had exactly the same test, but the participant number was written in black or in green. Those that the participant number was written in red performed worse.
Both
mathematical and verbal tests. Unbelievable.
You know, it's funny as you say that. I think it's kind of believable because from the time we were little children in kindergarten, red was always the color that showed us we did something wrong.
Exactly. So,
But the flip side of that is a woman in a red dress or a woman in a different color dress that has a red background that's framed by a red background that elicits very positive feelings in men. Can you talk about that, Thelma?
Sure. That's exactly like you said, the flip one, because red has both the association of danger and stop, and like you say, the teacher always marked our exams in red, but it also is a symbol of passion and love, mm-hmm. and therefore it depends on the context. So in that particular study that you're referring to, men were shown photos of a woman. All three groups showed the same photo. Only one group saw it depicted against a red color, one the other one against another color like green, and another group against gray. I'm saying like because there were several studies. Each time they compared it to other colors. And then they were asked about that woman, how attractive she is, how sexy she is, how desirable she is, whether they would like to have sex with her. In one study, they even asked how much money they would spend on her on a date. And all came the same results. Those who saw the same woman depicted against a red background perceived her as more attractive, more sexy. They wanted to have sex with her more than the other groups. And they said they would spend more money on her on a date.
Very interesting. If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Thelma Lobel. She's the author of Sensation, the New Science of Physical Intelligence. And Dr. Lobel, wanted to ask you a little bit about moving into human touch and relationships face-to-face. And you do a great job of bringing in some pop culture. It was George Clooney's role as Ryan Bingham in Up in the Air. And then it's Carrie Bradshaw in Sex and the City. She gets broken up with by her boyfriend via post-it note.
Exactly.
She's furious. And in the case of George Clooney, he, of course, if you've seen the movie, you remember it was very important to him to fire people face-to-face. So talk about human interaction face-to-face and then touch.
Yeah. So these two examples that I bring in the book, I loved them because if you think about it, people do expect good news and bad news to be told to them face-to-face because, you know, in this world that we are talking so much via Skype and phones are not an issue anymore, but, you know, people talk all the time in their phones seeing the face of the other person, and still it's not the same. I can tell you from my own experience, I live in Israel part of the time, and my granddaughters live in California. And I talk with them with the Skype, which is better than nothing, but it's definitely not the same as being near them. So I know from my own experience how you have to see the person and touch it, touch that person. So first of all, there were several studies that showed that it's not the same. Even though you see the face of the person, so then you have the nonverbal communication, you still, it's not the same as sitting in the same room, watching all the differences, the subtle movements that you can't see everything on the phone or on the computer. There was one study, for example, that showed that just when people were asked to point to close or distant point dots on a page, it affected how emotionally close they felt to other people. The closer...
Wow.
Seriously. Yeah. And they were asked... in one study, for example, they were asked to one group was asked to put two dots very close to each other, and the other group distance from each other. And then they were read a story that was very embarrassing. They were asked their opinion about that story. Now think about it. If you're emotionally close, you're more embarrassed. You don't want to hear about somebody who was abused by somebody else, etc. And if you're emotionally distanced, you care less about it. And that's what happened. Those who drew very close dots felt more emotionally close, and then they were more embarrassed hearing all these details compared to those who drew a distant dots.
Thelma, in your book, there's research that you have performed, and you also cite examples of studies and research that was done by other people. Are you satisfied that the sample size and those sorts of things and statistical studies and things like that was performed?
I'll tell you, the size of the studies were not big, but there were all the studies that I bring in my book, really all of them were statistically significant. And the more the smaller the sample size, the more difficult it is to reach significance. So what I'm bringing is always studies that were published in top journals and came out statistically significant. However, there were occasions that people wrote that they couldn't replicate some of the studies. And my notion is, and I write it at the end of the epilogue, is that now is the time for the second generation studies, which means, okay, we have shown this phenomena, which is really amazing and teaches us a lot, but now let's see, maybe it affects some people more than others. Let's see the moderator variables or the mediating variables. Maybe in some environments it affects more than others, in some cultures more than others. It depends on the individual differences. As I said, some people might be more sensitive to physical sensations than others. Even political opinions might influence. Okay. So the second generation should come to more refined studies that show who are the people that are influenced more, when, where, maybe the ambient temperature affects also. All these things were not done yet, most of them.
So for an example, if we have any single guys in Park City who are thinking of rubbing a jelly donut on their chest before asking some woman that they're interested in to get her telephone number, what is the percentage of success rates for the person that asked for a woman's telephone number where there was a pastry aroma versus where there was no pastry aroma?
I don't remember the number. I can tell you it was the difference was big enough to be significant. I don't remember the number now. But it definitely more women gave them numbers, significantly more women gave them. That actually was enough, quite a big sample, and they went near clothing stores or near bakeries. I wouldn't recommend putting on their chest because then they will, like you asked me in the beginning, there will be other factors that might be gross.
Oh, Thelma, you don't know my single friends.
It's really a pleasure to be interviewed with you.
Well, it's been a pleasure to have you. Lynn and I both very much enjoyed your book. Unfortunately, we are out of time. But thank you very much for joining us. And will you come back and talk to us in the future?
Of course. I'll be delighted.
Okay. Thank you, Thelma.
We want to thank Dr. Thelma Lobel for being our guest today and for this fascinating and intriguing conversation. We'll take a quick break for our underwriters, and when we return, we'll be talking with David Waltham, author of Lucky Planet, Why Earth is So Exceptional, and What That Means for Life in the Universe. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts from Park City Medical Center, a nonprofit community hospital and part of the Intermountain Healthcare System. Park City Medical Center is proud to be consistently recognized as having some of the most engaged employees in the country. Little wonder, considering we offer all employees a pension plan, 401k, excellent insurance, and of course, year-round employment. We are currently recruiting nurses, registrars, housekeepers, kitchen staff, and more. Visit parkcitymedicalcenter.org to find your dream job.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host John Wells. Well, we were just talking with Dr. Thelma Lobel, author of Sensation, the New Science of Physical Intelligence. And while we're waiting to get our next guest on the phone, let's talk about cars that drive themselves.
Oh, today's cool story. Well, since 2011, Google has been experimenting with cars, autonomous cars, they call them, that drive themselves. They have over 700,000 miles now in testing. And recently, they've been really focusing on city life, and they're getting a lot better.
Well, yeah, they're getting a lot better. So good, in fact, that the only reported accidents have happened with autonomous cars when one of the cars was actually being driven by a person, or if it was the fault of another driver. So autonomous cars are now legal in California, Florida, Michigan, and Nevada, although all states still require a human driver behind the wheel. And this is kind of funny. Like, I guess you would have an autonomous car and not want to go if, say, you wanted, you know, it to take your 6-year-old to school or something. I mean, why else would you not also be in the car?
Well, there's lots of reasons, I think. These are just some thoughts. I was thinking about this. If you think about city traffic today and you think about pollution, now, what if you were going to the theater or you were going to a bar and your car drops you off at the theater in the city and then leaves the city and parks in the autonomous parking lot and parks with all these other autonomous cars? Now you have less traffic and you have less pollution. And, well, if you're going to the theater, maybe not so much. But if you're going to the bar, you're going to have less DUIs.
Oh, yes. Less DUIs. I like this. So I don't really know. I haven't heard too much about this. In fact, I have scarcely heard at all about autonomous cars. I know you follow these things a little more closely, but, you know, in terms of reaction time, I suppose you could say a machine's going to be faster than a human in reaction time.
Well, yes. And starting, you know, actually, you know, Google's been doing this since 2011, but about 10 years ago, I was with the CEO of Raytheon back in Massachusetts, and we were in a car that had a radar and had autonomous capability. And we were driving all over the place. I mean, they had this thing down pat, and we had a lot of fun with it. But I'm not going to tell you what I thought, but I think this has been going on behind the scenes for a while as well, Lynn. And I think this is where we're going.
Right. Well, it's interesting still, though, with any machine, you know, there's always the argument for the human element being important. And in this case, I believe that when I'm driving along, I can ascertain whether people are texting and driving. I see in the cars around me, you know, pay attention to this stuff. What's going on in the drivers around me?
Exactly.
And I think that's a human element that can't be duplicated.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm still just trying to argue for the good old fashioned human piloting the car. I don't know.
Yeah, you could do that. I would also mention for people that are now afraid to drive in California, Florida, Michigan, or Nevada that, although autonomous driving is legal and there's testing being done by Google and other companies, it is still required that a human being be in the car. So even though the cars are making some decisions, the human being can override and that sort of thing.
That's right. All very interesting. I'm not ready to take a ride in one just yet, I don't think. Or maybe I am. It's really not that scary, is it?
You know what would be cool? Be like an autonomous boyfriend.
Oh, don't get started on that. Maybe, though.
Yeah, I mean, well, we'll talk later.
Let's take a quick break for some underwriters, and we'll be back with our next guest, David Waltham. He's the author of Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. This is Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. Low Stump Tree Service, Park City's Local Tree Care, 435-200-5730. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. We're just talking with Thelma Lobel, author of Sensation, The New Science of Physical Intelligence. Our second guest this morning is David Waltham. He is the author of Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. describing the three factors that typically control a planet's average temperature: the heat received from its star, how much heat the planet absorbs, and the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Waltham paints a complex picture of how special Earth's climate really is. He untangles the mystery of why surface temperatures have never fluctuated so much as to make conditions hostile to life. Citing factors such as the size of our moon and the effect of an ever-warming sun, Waltham challenges the prevailing scientific consensus that other Earth-like planets have natural stabilizing mechanisms that allow life to flourish. David Waltham, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hello.
Well, thank you for joining us today, David. And it's a fascinating bit of science and research that you put forth. Interesting that just yesterday we spoke with another astrobiologist, and his name was Lewis Dartnell. He wrote the book Knowledge. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he talks about how to rebuild.
Yeah.
Oh, you are?
I know Lewis very well, yes.
Okay. Yes, both British.
Yeah.
but, you know, it's interesting that he also studies life or lack thereof on Mars, and then he brings it back to what happens if our world becomes more limited here on Earth. How do we rebuild that? And so it's just a fascinating kind of juxtaposition between the two views. But let's start here. Let's start with maybe a little history on the study of, is there life on Mars? It's very fascinating. We've studied it, I think, probably for centuries. But can you lead us through it?
Yes, certainly. The story really starts in the late 19th century when there's an Italian astronomer called Schiaparelli who thought he saw lines on the surface of Mars, which he called canali. that got translated into English as canals. And very rapidly, everyone started to assume that those were artificial and created by intelligent beings. And there's a very famous astronomer called Lowell, who built a telescope in Tucson, Arizona, telescope, and he studied Mars for several decades. And that was the conclusion he came to. Mars was definitely inhabited by intelligent life, and the canals were the result of them attempting to irrigate Mars. Unfortunately, when we got there with space probes, there were no sign of the canals. They were actually a figment of our imagination.
That's interesting. Kind of like, I don't know, crop circles or, well, I don't know what else, but a figment of,
yeah, I think the best analogy is actually ley lines. Do you know what ley lines are? I'm not sure if you talk about them.
Yes, and I think that's what I was trying to say.
Yes. Yeah, that's the idea that there are sort of ancient monuments and they line up to make lines of power. And, essentially, if you've got random dots, you can always line them up with straight lines. The constellations is another good example. And the human brain is just very good at seeing patterns which aren't there.
Yes, interesting. So take us forward from the imaginary canals into what was the next sort of real scientific finding on Mars?
Yeah, but I think the really big thing was about 1998, 1999, thereabouts, when NASA announced that a meteorite from Mars had signs of life in it. This is a meteorite that was actually picked up in Antarctica. But when it was studied, what they found in it were chemicals that are very similar to chemicals we expect life to produce. And they even thought they could see with an electron microscope some really tiny microbes, much, much smaller than we expect microbes to be, but really small things that looked like little worms. So they were saying that this is evidence for life on Mars. It has to be said that most people don't think the case holds up. So although it's still a controversial area and some people still argue that that meteorite does show signs of life from Mars, most astrobiologists don't believe it.
So this little planet of ours here on Earth, 4 billion years old, it's an extraordinary planet, and you believe that it is extraordinary as compared to what is understood of the known universe. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The key thing here is the sheer enormous size of the universe, the fact that there are trillions and trillions of planets. And people have often argued that there are so many planets out there that that there must be other life out there. And actually, I agree with that. But the point is, it's so many that life could be very, very rare, and there would still be lots of it out there. So we don't need to assume that life is actually very common, or intelligent life very common, in order to explain our own existence. It's quite possible that there's only one planet like the Earth in the entire visible universe, but the universe is so enormous, there would still be billions of such worlds. It's just the nearest one would be so far away that we'll never see it.
Well, that, of course, accepts the assumption, and a good assumption, that light speed is the speed limit of the universe, and that's continues to be tested. But in this three, or I guess Einstein believes there's a fourth dimension he calls space-time, when you consider what people are proposing for string theory, where there might be 11 or 12 or 13 different dimensions, I mean, it is possible that that the speed limit of the universe would be much faster than the speed of light. So therefore, we would have access to these planets or systems on the far side of the universe. Do you believe that is possible?
You're starting to get way outside my area of expertise, to be honest, but I would be very doubtful. I think the paradoxes that emerge if you allow faster-than-light travel, because essentially that allows time travel as well. You get all the paradoxes that come along with that. So I think it's extremely unlikely that we can break the light barrier. But I'm not a specialist in this area. You'd really need to talk to someone else on that.
Yeah, because I was just reading that in quantum mechanics they're able to have an outcome simultaneously in two places instantaneously without any difference in time. So I don't know. It's all pretty bizarre, but it's certainly going to take a while.
That's definitely the quantum entanglement experiments. Which,
yes.
As my understanding goes, you can't send a signal that way, so it doesn't actually violate anything in Einstein's relativity. Although it is still something that's very, very hard to understand and get your head around. Mm-hmm. I certainly struggle with it.
Yes.
So I don't think it actually suggests that we can travel faster than light.
No, but it's just that it's just fascinating. It's just more we need to learn about.
It is. Oh. Yeah. Absolutely fascinating, yes.
Now, just another question back to Earth, and that is the primordial soup where life began. Have we ever been able to replicate that soup and been able to see life emerge?
No, not at all. We've made very little progress, to be honest. Some people might disagree with me on this, but we've made very little progress on understanding how life starts. There is some progress. We're experimenting with organisms and trying to make them as simple as we can and still be viable. So it's all, from the top down. And people are trying to make chemical broths of self-replicating molecules. So they're sort of trying to build life up from the bottom there. But it's still very early days, and there's no real progress. And certainly all the experiments that anyone's tried to do that are in any way realistic end up with a horrible goo that's nothing like life. It's just a mess.
Mm.
So it's not something we understand.
Right. Well, let's talk about some of the things that we do understand and that you've come to understand in your research, David. And one of those is so interesting about gravity and why you believe that just the sheer lack of as much gravity as we have here on Earth could not support life on Mars. Talk about that, if you would.
I'm not quite sure what you're alluding to there. Possibly tidal forces and the effect they have on our climate.
Well, I had read that the amount of the force of gravity on Mars is about, 40% of what we have here on Earth. And that in itself would not allow sort of normal functioning to go about to support life. Did I get that wrong? I could have.
No. I mean, the key issue there, I guess, is holding onto an atmosphere. And Mars's atmosphere is very, very thin, much thinner than Earth. And a large part of the reason for that is because it's a smaller body with smaller gravity. So essentially, molecules of gases in the atmosphere are moving fast enough to escape. They're beyond the escape velocity and they disappear into space. So that's certainly one of the reasons. It's not the only reason, but one of the reasons why Mars has got a very thin atmosphere. And that thin atmosphere is what stops it having liquid water. And that is key to life. So, yeah, certainly it's very hard to see how a body the size of Mars could ever be a very hospitable place.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about climate then. And it's funny, when I first picked up your book, I thought, oh, you know, Mr. Waltham is trying to make us feel better about climate change and global warming in his book, which I suppose in some ways you are. But talk about that and the climate on Mars.
Yeah. When I'm feeling a bit mischievous, what I'd sometimes say, what the book's actually about is the link between climate change and flying saucers. But there is a link, and you're quite right. The link comes because it's the fact that our biosphere is very sensitive to small changes in the climate system. That has two consequences. One is that's why we're worried about global warming. Quite rightly, we should be worried about it. But secondly, it also makes it very hard to understand how a planet can maintain a stable climate for billions of years, because it's that sensitivity to change that causes the problems. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And what do you consider, what are the elements of a stable climate and a stable temperature? Because, you know, we just think of it as fluctuating so much, and we think of an ice age and a warming and how much havoc it wreaks on our planet.
Yeah, it's all relative, really.
Yeah.
But when I say climate is stable, I mean it's not varying by more than a few tens of degrees centigrade over billions of years, but that's still a massive change from the point of view of life. The last ice age was only 4 degrees cooler than the present day is, but that was enough for the ice sheets to extend thousands of miles closer to the equator than they do now. So even quite small temperature changes can make big differences. But the sorts of temperature changes that would be required to wipe life out completely are, you need to get to the point where water disappears, either because it gets so hot that all the water boils out in the oceans and there's no liquid water left, or it gets so cold that it all freezes and there's no liquid water left that way either. Now, that requires rather larger climate change. It requires climate change of, let's say, 50 centigrade or so either way. And that seems to be rather higher than typically has happened on the Earth. There's been a few occasions when we got close, but mostly we've stayed well within that range, and we've seen fluctuations which are just a few tens of centigrade. Now, that is a lot from the point of view of the effect it has on life, but it's much less than I would have expected given the sorts of changes that have happened to the Earth's atmosphere and to the brightness of the sun and so on. I'd have expected that to produce much larger changes than the ones we've seen.
David, I was interested to read that since the beginning, 4 billion years ago, our sun has increased in intensity 40% or so, because it is, it will be a red giant one day. Is that basically it?
That's essentially it, though we're talking about much smaller changes. What will happen in, I think that's not for about another 4 billion years or so, is it will get a lot bigger and it will happen quite suddenly. But well before that, there's a gradual, much slower change over the whole history of the sun. So in a sense, it's a bit like what's going to happen eventually. It is getting larger. It is actually swelling up slowly as it ages. And eventually that swelling will accelerate and then it will turn into a red giant. But long, long before that happens, the more gradual swelling that I'm talking about is enough to make the Earth uninhabitable. So we don't have to wait until the sun becomes a red dwarf before we have these sorts of problems.
Right. There's some relationship between gravity and decay of photons. Or as the sun emits more photons, its mass decreases, and then gravity has less of a role, and that's why it expands, and that's why it's we've seen that change?
No, the real reason is the fact that the fuel in the center of the sun, the hydrogen that it uses, that it turns into helium, as that happens, essentially it's polluting itself. It's the helium ash, almost, that's produced by that mechanism is collecting at the center of the sun, and that actually stops the center of the sun from having nuclear reactions. As a result of that, the energy source in the center of the sun is slowly migrating outwards. And if it does so, it's actually generating more heat. If you like, it's a slightly larger ball. It's a similar thickness. It's a slightly difference between, say, a a baseball and a soccer ball, the thickness of the skin is about the same, but there's much more plastic in the soccer ball. In the same way, as the core of the sun, the bit of the sun that's generating the heat expands, so the total amount of heat that it's producing goes up. Okay. So it's because the center of the sun is no longer producing heat.
Right.
It sounds almost counterintuitive. You expect the heat to go down. It actually does the opposite.
David, we don't have a lot of time left, but I did have one final question, and that is, what is the role of our moon in helping to stabilize the temperature on Earth?
Right. Now, that's where I think everyone gets that one wrong. It's frequently said that the large moon stabilizes our axis. And it's certainly true that, you can do this with a computer model. If you magically remove the moon, then the Earth's axis starts to wobble much, much more than it currently does. And because it's the angle of our axis that creates the seasons, if that angle is changing a lot, then we get very, very chaotic weather conditions, which would be extremely unpleasant. So there's no doubt that taking the moon away would produce an unstable axis, but it's actually asking the wrong question. We shouldn't ask what would happen if we magically took the moon away, because taking the moon away is not the same as not having one in the first place. The important question is, what would have happened if we'd had a slightly larger moon in the first place? And if you model that situation, what you actually find is that a larger moon actually makes the Earth's axis unstable sooner than it would otherwise be. It accelerates the movement towards instability. So actually, what I'm saying in the book, and it's something that contradicts a lot of what you read in other literature, I'm actually saying that our large moon very nearly destabilizes our axis.
And what's
really interesting is we're very, very close to the limit. The calculations I've done is the moon had been something like about 20 miles bigger. That would have been enough for us to have an unstable axis today. So that to me is one of the very interesting things that's come out from this work.
Yes.
We're extraordinarily close to actually having an uninhabitable planet. It just needed a very slightly larger moon.
That's fascinating. Well, you outlined this and other really interesting points. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but David Waltham, thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio. David is the author of Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Cool Science Radio. We'll be right back.
Hey, Dave, when is the best time for a story?
Sunday mornings at 8:30.
Hi, this is Kathy.
And I'm Dave. We're co-hosts of The Story Mine. Tune in Sunday mornings right here at KPCW.
Experience the treasures of storytelling every Sunday morning at 8:30.
Want to thank our listeners for tuning in to Cool Science Radio today. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells. Want to thank our guest, Thelma Lobel, the author of Sensation, The New Science of Physical Intelligence. Very interesting. And also David Waltham, the author of Lucky Planet.
Also, we want to thank our sponsors, San Francisco Design, Prudential Real Estate, and Peak Art and Frame. And of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't thank Beth Fratkin, our producer. And also want to mention tomorrow, well, today is May Day, but tomorrow on Friday, celebrate the month of May with Basin Recreation's Cinco de Mayo and the Kentucky Derby.
That's all on Fun Friday at 9 a.m. Of course, you can access archived programs of Cool Science Radio on kpcw.org. Just go to the Shows tab in Cool Science Radio. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. Time now for news.